Chapter 3. Organizing the Work. "You all must work hard to organize the work after I am gone," Master had said. "Otherwise you won't be able to handle all those who will be coming to you." It was never Master's task to organize the work in the sense here implied. His spirit was too free to be tied down to earthly systems. But what he offered as a general exhortation, I took as a personal summons. Once I put my mind to it, I discovered that I had a natural flair for organizing. I was able to see instantly what was needed and what consequences, whether good or bad, would accrue years later even from any decisions taken today. People, I realized, were more important to any working system. The highest priority was to enlist their willing cooperation and support. I had already done much in the way of organizing through my work with the monks. Most of them were now attending the morning and evening meditations. We kept silence together at the dining table in accordance with Master's wishes. Also, in accordance with his wishes, I had organized a series of classes in discipleship and had written elaborate notes for them so that others would be able to cover the same subjects in future, benefiting from the preparation I had done for them. I accepted frankly that, whereas monks on fire for God might find it onerous to have to attend relatively short daily meditations with the others, at least the others' meditations would become regular. Even racehorses, I reasoned, could be slowed down by reluctant nags in the community who hardly meditated at all, and the overall morale, I felt, would greatly improve if fewer novices left the monastery to return to a worldly life. For it caused me deep anguish to see so many promising young men leave the monastery, all because we lacked a sufficiently strong group magnetism to hold them. Master himself was too seldom with the men to give them a sense of abiding reality in their way of life there. He was busy finishing his writings. The classes in discipleship I now held regularly would also, I felt, be a strong factor in strengthening the group magnetism. Another factor would be faithfulness to our few rules. How often, just to ensure that silence was kept, I had had to give up my own meditations and come early to the dining room to sit there until everyone had finished eating and left. Even so, to get the monks to maintain silence proved impossible at first. Their old habit of talking at the table was deeply entrenched. Finally, I hit on the idea of keeping silence only at breakfast, which immediately followed the morning meditation. This practice proved relatively easy for people to abide by. After some time, I suggested we keep silence at the table in the evening also, after the evening meditation. Having grown accustomed to not speaking at breakfast, the monks found little difficulty in adjusting themselves to this extension of the rule. I was pleased, finally, to see that they had come to enjoy the silence so much that there was no need to propose we all keep it at lunchtime as well. By then, lunch was already being eaten in silence. Another problem we had concerned the monks' accommodations. So many were coming that there was no place to put them except in a single crowded room in what was known as the monks' cottage. These were new monks, remember, entering a monastery that had never been organized before, and for which no real models existed. The newcomers who slept in the large room, strangers to group discipline, talked, argued, and joked half the night, their exuberance preventing even those who wanted to meditate from pursuing their spiritual practices. My room was in another cottage with a basement that I'd converted into a meditation room. To keep the cottage discipline from breaking down, however, I moved into the large dormitory room with the new monks. There I lived for a year and a half until the situation became stabilized. By this time, I had the satisfaction of seeing monks come and not, for the most part, leave. From our prior resemblance to a loosely organized camp, we began to become a true monastery. The women, meanwhile, growingly aware of my efforts with the men, began to organize themselves also, following more or less closely the system I'd started. Sister Shraddha borrowed my class notes and used them in classes she developed for the nuns. My notes finally became known as Shraddha's notes, a point that wouldn't even deserve mention were it not for the subsequent effort to discredit everything I did, actually to the point of Tara's insisting that I was never even a disciple. Master's words to me, "You have a great work to do," meant to me only one thing, that I must apply myself energetically to whatever that work was. I had no interest in drawing credit to myself, but only in getting the work done. But I was confident that if I put forth good energy and enthusiasm, the path to accomplishment would open before me. Enthusiastically, I set forth to organize whatever needed organizing, since organizing was evidently what was needed, and since I found I did have a certain flair for it. Still, I wondered why Master hadn't mentioned organizing among the things he wanted me to do.